You are listening to Over and Back's Basketball Mysteries of the 70s. Today's mystery is, are the 71-72 Lakers the most impressive team ever? Hi, this is Jason, and my guest is Sean Fury. He is the author of Rise and Fire, The Origin, Science, and Evolution of the Jump Shot, and How It Transformed Basketball Forever. Returning to our program. Sean, welcome back.
Awesome to be back, Jason.
So you are a big Lakers fan. You are not old enough to know the 69 through 73 Lakers in particular, but you had I know that your family followed the team closely from previous conversations, and obviously as a man who knows his basketball history, obviously know the important parts of this team. But you know, what kind of, to you, what does sort of this era of the Lakers represent?
I think, failure is really, I think a lot, the first word that kind of pops to mind in that, you have this entire decade of just these devastating, heartbreaking, occasionally bizarre, snake-bitten losses that if they happened, it's always tough, we've talked about this before, comparing eras, but you think if there was a team today that in a 9-year span lost 7 finals with 2 guys and West and Baylor, who at that time, if you were making an all-time NBA team, almost certainly would have been in the starting 5. And yet, year after year, they suffer these losses. So just these devastating defeats that they went through, but yet at the end managed to put together one of the best teams in NBA history. It's kind of a crazy way that it didn't end for them, of course, because the next year, they lost again in the finals, but it was such an amazing way to cap kind of that decade of failure. The unfortunate part, of course, being that Elgin Baylor, the guy who suffered along with West more than anyone, wasn't there to enjoy the final victory. But I think just when you think about that decade and then into the early 70s, it's really, I think, the defeats and the losses that probably stand out even more than that 72 season. But I think the 33-game winning streak sort of does put them on a pedestal where that is something that's very memorable, set them apart from every other team in NBA history, really, even if their 69 wins was broken. But just that decade of utter heartbreak finally ending in triumph at a time when their best players were past their prime, another kind of remarkable aspect of it.
Yeah, absolutely. So overall, the team had 4 finals appearances in 5 years, winning the 1972 NBA championship. That year, they had a 69-13 record, which would set the record for wins at the time, including the 33-game winning streak, which we'll get into a bit later. And they also had the Basketball Reference's SRS, which weighs in strength of schedule and victory margin, has them as the 3rd best regular season team ever. They, of course, were able to team 3 of the greatest players ever in history, Elgin Baylor, Jerry West, and Wilt Chamberlain, all on one team. Really the first super team, in a sense, with Wilt using his leverage to force a trade that would later echo a trend of in the 70s of players gaining more power and using it to switch teams or switch leagues and so forth. The 1972 team is the best single-season team of that decade. And really, these Lakers, compared to every other pretty successful team in the 70s, are one of the best remembered teams of that time period, other than perhaps the Knicks, and probably and obviously the rivalry between them and the Knicks winning 2 of those 3 finals is part of that. And the 72 team really became the great team that all future great teams were compared to, at least single season teams, until the 1996 Bulls. We're kind of, My thought here is that that perhaps the 71 and 72 Lakers are, I wouldn't call them necessarily the best team ever, although they certainly have that argument, but I would say that there's a good chance that they're the most impressive team ever, just based on where they initially came from, where their stars were in that stage of their career. Elgin Baylor retiring 9 games in the season, having a similar team, but having a new coach bring in a completely new approach to the team and getting those guys to buy in. And the fact that they had this remarkable streak and this remarkably difficult schedule, The fact that they were able to then go into the playoffs and beat another one of the best regular season teams of all time, and then finally finish off a, you know, one of their fierce rivals in the finals. So we'll kind of get into some of the specifics there, but that's sort of where that would be my argument for why they might be the most impressive team. We don't need to conclude that argument right now, but do you think that there's a chance, perhaps? Do you think I'm not off base when I, you know, perhaps make that claim as a possibility?
No, I think you're definitely on track. And I think part of it is because of those failures we talked about. I mean, if, again, trying to put it in modern terms, if you think of, say if Kobe and Shaq had gone from 2002 to 2010 and lost 7 finals and never won one, and then a few years later win 69 games, win 33 in a row, you know, kind of just overcoming all those skeletons and then putting together the season that the Lakers, until that year, had never won even 60 games in a season. And obviously the schedule was shorter for part of that. But they had, you know, 55, I think, was the most before that. And they'd won 48 the year before. So the leap they took and the way they did it, you know, finally putting together these parts that individually were always awesome, but now finally came together as this ultimate team, combining it with, you know, the winning streak really does set them apart in a way, because I was thinking about this today with Golden State this year, obviously winning 24 in a row, remarkable accomplishment, but they still would have had to win 10 in a row to beat that streak, and a 10-game winning streak is an amazing accomplishment in itself. So I definitely think they have to be in the conversation for the most impressive single season. Like you said, that doesn't necessarily mean the best team ever. Not that we can solve that question anyway, but as far as just single season accomplishments, they have to be near the top, if not at the very top.
Yes, and the greatest mysteries is about, it's about investigating the mysteries, not necessarily about solving the mystery. We're not promising any solving here, so I want to make that clear to the listeners that we, you know, we are, you know, we're detectives, but not every detective you know, solves the case at the end. So just
it'll end on a cliffhanger.
I'm sorry.
It'll end on a cliffhanger.
Exactly. Yes. So. So the key players, of course, of the dynasty, they are well known. Jerry West, one of the great guards of all time, the logo of the league, already at this point was considered one of the greatest clutch players ever, even though he had failed in 5 previous times in the finals. Heading into the 69 season, they would lose again in 1970, of course. And then he had one of his best seasons in 1970. Actually, has a decent argument for winning the MVP, which went to Willis Reed that year. Led the NBA with 31.2 points per game. Will missed most of that season, and Baylor missed 28 games. Then in 72, when he was asked to be more of a playmaker under Bill Sharman, actually led the league in assists. So even though he was at age 30 in 1969, so he was in his 30s as this run was progressing, still was probably the best guard in the league up until his retirement, or very close to that level. I can't think of anyone off the top of my head, because he kind of eclipsed Oscar a little bit as Oscar aged, and not necessarily anyone who stood out is certainly, you know, maybe on his level, but no one who was, you know, who was better than him, other than, you know, perhaps his Gail Goodrich, who we'll talk about in a little bit, his backcourt mate, would be the only guy who was kind of even in that tier that I can think of.
Yeah, and West has become kind of the symbol of the tormented years that they suffered, because he was so open with how the losing affected him. But like I said, he maintained his incredible play, and he finally retired when he would tell reporters, because he always gave, there's a plethora of great quotes from West, whether years after he played or even during his playing days, and he was very honest and talked about when he felt his level of play had diminished, you know, even a little bit, mostly due to injuries and age, of course, that he knew it was time to be done. But even in his last years, he was, the Lakers still counted on him to be the man.
Yeah, absolutely. And then Will Chamberlain, who was 32 when he joined the team in 1969. And even though his scoring was down at this point in his career, he was still averaging, during his time with the Lakers, he averaged 17.7 points per game, 19.2 rebounds per game, 4.3 assists, and .206 win shares per 48. So still elite level production during that time, and, you know, leading your team to the finals, 4 times in 5 years is a you know, I think that shows that he was playing in the elite level as well. It wasn't just putting up those numbers, even though, you know, they didn't have as much success as they would have liked in the finals. Still, getting there four times in 5 years is pretty impressive. Chamberlain, he suffered his first really serious injury of his career. It was a knee injury, 9 games in the 1970 season that was feared career-threatening. He actually, and this would have been after the 69 finals, where he famously injured his knee and asked to be taken out of the game, and then his coach Butch Van Prelikoff wouldn't let him back into the game. We talked about that with in our WrestleMania series with Wilt and the Wilt and Russell episode. And he was able to rehab by, it talks about in his talked about in the biography of Wilt Larger Than Life, basically rehab by copying racehorse techniques. He ran in ocean water, he jumped in soft sand, he did hill climbing on a bicycle, and he was able to was able to return from this injury for the playoffs and led the team to the finals in 1970. They took the Knicks to 7 games. It's kind of funny, in that finals, Wilt, or, you know, Willis Reed is lauded for, you know, gutting it out and going out there, to, you know, with his knee injury and the emotional moment in Madison Square Garden. But Wilt, of course, had dealt with overcoming a tremendous injury as well. And Jerry West in the same game actually had injections in his hand to help him play in the game, which are, you know, not to take away from Reed's moment, but, you know, those are other things that aren't as well known that are also, you know, pretty remarkable, you know, return from injuries or, you know, battling through to, you know, performing that game, even though they didn't win.
And I think that's one thing I think it's easy to forget when you talk about players back then and dealing with these injuries without having access, obviously, to modern medical marvels that help players and not only play in individual games, but just prolong their careers, and whether it's minutes played. I mean, you look at the minutes played for those Lakers teams and how old. I mean, like you said, Wilt, mid-30s, Elgin, a couple years older, West, 33 in that 72 season, but they're still playing 40 minutes per game, you know, unfathomable in today's game. And the injuries, you know, you read these stories. I was just looking at a Sports Illustrated one today, and you mentioned West's hands, and he's getting injections before games. You know, they're basically just shooting these guys up, and that's something that's really remarkable, I think, about those, that era, is, you know, these guys' careers, it just, I think you guys have tweeted about this, and we've talked about this, when you think about guys playing into their 30s back then, and playing really well, it just wasn't done that much. And so that's another remarkable sort of aspect about those, that 72 team especially, is that in Wilt and West, who were still around, you had these guys who weren't at a prime age for being dominant, but they still were that season.
Yeah, and then, of course, so at this point, when Wilt crossed 30,000 points for his career in 1972, the Lakers had 3 of the 4 highest scorers in NBA history on their team, had the most points. Oscar was second with 24,692 points. Baylor had 23,000 points, and West had just under 23,000 points.
Yeah.
It just kind of gives you a sense of, like, wow, you know, where this team was, where those guys were in the realms of NBA history. As you talked about, you know, honestly, all three guys would almost certainly be, you know, an all-time all-NBA team. Of course, you'd have to deal with Russell and Chamberlain and who you picked there, or, you know, fudging that. But still, obviously, you know, they were three of the, you know, 5 or 6 best players in NBA history up to that point. So Baylor, he was 34 in 1969 as this team kind of is put together with Chamberlain being added. I guess I forgot to mention that Chamberlain was he of course was the reigning MVP when he came over in 68 and had led the Sixers to the 67 title despite many past failures versus Bill Russell Celtics, as we talked about the 69 team failing. So at this point, you know, Baylor was kind of the guy who really first, you know, he was the first superstar in Los Angeles before West emerged, and one of the legendary small forwards of all time, you know, just innovative offensive player with dynamic moves and above the rim game. And toward the end of his career, knee injuries robbed him of a lot, although he was still reasonably productive in his last few seasons. 23.4 points per game, 10.2 rebounds per game, 5.1 assists per game, and a .145 win share per 48, which is still, you know, very above average. So, to be at the end of his career and still putting up those numbers is pretty strong. So as far as Baylor goes, just kind of in general, you know, he's the guy. He was the guy who kind of really, made basketball in Los Angeles really kind of lifted it to another level in prominence. I talked to Bijan Bain in a previous episode and he wrote a book about Elgin Baylor. For you as a Lakers fan and as a basketball historian, you know, what kind of comes to mind for you as far as Baylor goes?
I think everything you just said as far as how innovative he was, you know, playing a style that really hadn't, you know, certainly there were probably a couple other guys that were doing similar things, but not putting up the numbers or the dominance that he displayed while also playing with that flair. And, you know, for me, first thing when I hear Elgin Baylor, it's, and I've told the story previously on here, but he was my dad's favorite player when, because he actually, unlike Wes, played with the Minneapolis Lakers before they moved. And my, you know, being from Minnesota, my family loved the Lakers, and Elgin was my dad's number one guy. So that's always what I've associated Elgin Baylor with. And then just the, I still love reading, you know, looking at the old box scores of those West pre-Chamberlain, the West Baylor years, the scoring numbers that those two would put up, and just kind of this fight they had year after year trying to topple the Celtics and never being able to do it. And for me, Elgin's really, you know, just he's these remarkable numbers, and a lot of them were in the book you mentioned. And before Wilt, he was the one who set the single game NBA scoring record that had been set a decade earlier by Joel Foulkes. And it took Elgin's kind of, you know, evolutionary style to finally break that record before Wilt, of course, came along and put all the records to shame. But, you know, just this innovative guy who unfortunately retires, kind of this ultimate, you know, not tragedy is a big word, but as far as a player's career, just this tragedy of retiring in the year when, you know, the team goes on to its greatest glory. So
yeah,
he's just one of those kind of mythical guys, I think, in that early NBA history that was so important to the league, so important to the game. Like you said, so important to basketball in LA itself. Just unfortunate that he wasn't able to finally enjoy it that final season.
Yeah, and it was 0-8, and it ended up being 0-8 in the finals in his career, which, you know, getting to 8 finals is obviously really impressive, and, you know, you're battling against the Bill Russell dynasty for the most part during that time.
So we interrupt this great podcast that you're listening to. My name is Kevin Rafuse.
I'm Tim Tompkins.
And I'm Justin Cousart.
And we host the Drive and Dish NBA podcast.
We cover every team in the league and a bunch of really fun segments like Random NBA Player, Drive and Dougal, and Hot Takes from Reddit.
So when you're done listening to this podcast, give us a search on iTunes or whatever podcast streaming app you're listening on.
We're also at driveanddishpodcast.com. We are the Drive and Dish NBA podcast.
The other, you know, kind of main guy for the team, particularly in 72, who is less known, although still pretty well known, Gale Goodrich, who was a 6'1", 170-pound guard. When he joined the team in 71, he was age 27, so a bit younger than the rest of the guys. He was a left-hander with the nickname of Stumpy, was considered undersized and a bit of a gunner early on, although he showed playmaking ability and improved his defense in the 72 season. He actually spent 3 years with the Lakers in the late 60s, and then he was left unprotected and went to Phoenix in 1969, where he kind of started to thrive as a scorer and really, you know, showed himself as a star player, or, you know, a strong player. Then returned to the Lakers in 71, and then in the next season, the 72 season, he came into his own, led the team in scoring, and ranked fifth in the NBA with 25.9 points per game. He also ranked third in the league in free throw percentage and made a second All-Star game appearance. Overall, he was a five-time All-Star and spent one season on the All-NBA first team later in 74. So he stayed a star for another couple of years until the later 70s, and then fell off because of injuries once he was traded to the Jazz. So what about, as far as Goodrich goes, what stands out about him for you?
I think the thing with him is, I'm one of the, I don't remember when I would have read it. I was would have been a kid, but, you know, reading about the 72 Lakers, and it's kind of one of those stats when you first see it, if you don't know the history, it's just really startling when I first realized that he actually led the 72 Lakers in scoring. I just remember being shocked by that as a kid. And he, of course, only led, you know, looking up now, he only led by 0.1 points per game over West. But still, he had, you know, West and Chamberlain, two of the highest scorers in NBA history. But Gail Goodrich leads the team in scoring. I remember when I first started reading about that team, you know, first being like, well, who's that guy? And then how did he lead the team? And then when you read more and realize how the style of the team changed, what Bill Sharman, the coach, brought in, and, you know, just see how he was able to use Goodrich and how he kind of changed. There are stories about how, you know, Sharman kind of talked to West about changing his style of play, becoming more of a distributor. Like I said, he led the league in assists that year. And then Goodrich moving off the ball more, but being able to move without it, get the ball in great scoring position. And it's, you know, I don't know if I realized how tiny he was. Like you said, 6'1", which,
yeah, he was
in any era is a pretty small guard, so
sure,
yeah, pretty impressive what he did.
Yeah, and small guards were definitely not in vogue in the NBA. I guess by the early 70s, you know, in the ABA, some of the small guards were thriving, so that was kind of changing a little bit. But although he was actually only an inch or two shorter than West, at least West was listed. But West was so, like, he was longer and lither, where Goodrich, you know, he was actually kind of like, I mean, he kind of had short arms and was a little bit, you know, Stumpy was that was his nickname Elgin Baylor gave him. But that was kind of an appropriate nickname, to be honest. You know, even though he was a great player, but he definitely was a little bit more compact, I guess, for lack of a better term.
It's funny you mentioned, you know, Stumpy, you know, not the most flattering nickname. You know, he termed him endearment, I guess. But reading a story today, and another player we'll talk about, but Jim McMillan, a player on that 72 team, and one of his nicknames was Floyd Butterball. Another nickname given to him by Elgin Baylor, who apparently was, you know, I guess that was his role with that Lakers team at that stage, was the giver of not very flattering nicknames.
Yeah, absolutely. And speaking of McMillan, he really emerged in the 72 season, and once he replaced Baylor, which basically he just said he called it was just a routine assignment replacing God, as he filled in there. He was 23 in the 72 season, was his second year. And he played a lot more. He initially was overweight, and then he lost some of that weight. He looks pretty lithe in the, you know, video that I've seen in from those years. Averaged 15.3 points per game and 5.4 rebounds per game with the Lakers during that time. He recently passed away, unfortunately, but he had a pretty good career in the 70s. He spent a couple years with the Lakers and was traded to the Braves and had some good years there. I believe it was the same time that it was when they were pretty good with Bob McAdoo and you know, were a strong playoff team. And then lasted kind of later into the 70s with Dr. Jack Ramsey as their coach. Anything in particular about McMillan that stands out to you?
Well, I think the big thing, and you mentioned this, so maybe talk about it a little bit, but that year when they beat the Bucks in the playoffs in 1972, and that series was really, I guess the comparison would be if the Spurs and Warriors had actually played this year, as kind of these two powerhouses. The Bucks had won 63 games, I believe, that year, were the defending champions. Obviously, Kareem at his peak, even if Oscar wasn't. But in game one, the Bucks in L.A. run the Lakers off the court, 93-72, which was nearly 50 points below the Lakers' scoring average for that year. They averaged 121. But then in game two, the Lakers win 135-134, probably saving the season. If they would have gone down 2-0, losing two games at home, it would have been hard to see them beating Milwaukee. But in that game two, McMillan is the one. He scores 42 points and really sort of saves the Lakers season. And that was a story that I wasn't too familiar with. And so I was researching for, you know, our podcast here a little bit more, and just how important, you know, that game was and how epic that series really was overall.
Yeah. And we'll kind of, yeah, we'll get into a little bit more of the details of that series, but he definitely, you know, stood out there, even, you know, being the leading scorer of a game during that series, and helping put the team on. Not that he was the primary guy or anything, but definitely was stepping up and putting the team on his back when he needed to, which, considering the other names that were there, is very impressive. Happy Hairston, a power forward who was a stout rebounder, even alongside what I believe he was the first player to crack 1,000 rebounds in a season next to Wilt. 17 points per game, 11.9 rebounds per game during his time with the Lakers. He spent there 5.5 seasons after joining in 1970. He was also considered a good finisher on the fast break. Anything about him in particular?
I think, you know, the rebounding stands out, like you mentioned. Finally, a power forward playing next to Wilt, who, you know, certainly didn't match Wilt's numbers, but more than held his own and just played a big role in sparking that Lakers team is famous for, Charmin instituting this, you know, devastating fast break. And sort of the, you know, fast break is going to start with getting stops and then getting the rebound. So he played such a key role with that and really kind of filled out that starting lineup. You know, you think about, obviously today, positionless players are kind of all the rage, but certainly back then, you know, you have kind of the five set positions that team just really had. You have the center, you have the great guards, McMillan at small forward, and then Hairston at the four spot. You know, just kind of perfectly fit into his role on that team.
Yeah, and then other key guys, of course, were Pat Riley and Flynn Robinson, who kind of were sort of battled for the backup shooting guard position throughout most of the year. The Lakers were a team that very heavily uses top six or so guys and didn't dig into its bench too much. Of course, Riley, much more famous later for his coaching and executive career. At the time, he was 25 when he joined the team in 71 after 3 years with the San Diego Rockets. Flynn Robinson had come over from the Bucks and was he was called Mr. Instant Point by Chick Hearn, and sort of a scorer off the bench type player. So either of those guys, as far as their playing careers go.
Well, yeah, you mentioned Riley, of course, and one thing I enjoyed was, I think it was a quote after his playing days, but he was talking about that team, and the one thing he mentioned, he was famous in the 80s, of course, as a coach for hating the Celtics, and he played into the mythology of the 60s Celtics beating the Lakers. And as a player on that team, being coached by the former Celtic great Bill Sharman, and then his assistant, Casey Jones, who was also a great Celtics player. And Riley had a quote about how, you know, they were a little leery because Bill Sharman was covered in Boston green. And so you just picture Riley kind of having the same personality that we associate with him today, even as a GM. He's still, I think, he's kind of much slicker today, but still that very, you know, down in the dirt, gritty guy. And that's what he was as a player. And, you know, that's sort of what he brought to the team. And not that he, you know, like I said, he wasn't, you know, a huge contributor to that team, but they were very top heavy. But he was one of those guys who, like we talked about, the 72 team, instead of having all these great individuals that always came up short, finally were this ultimate team. And any team like that, you need role players like Riley and what he did that season.
Yeah, for sure. So looking at the overall season, the 1972 season and the winning streak, which was obviously the team's signature accomplishment. Bill Sharman was brought in, as you mentioned, the new coach in 72. The Lakers, their top stars were all considered, past their prime, over the hill. All three had dealt with a serious injuries. In fact, the previous coach, Joe Mullally, he had previous called them over the hill after his firing. So great way to go out there. So what Sharman, of course, as you mentioned, he was a Celtic great. He had been a outstanding shooting guard during the 50s and early 60s for the beginning Celtics dynasty, the first five or six years of the Bill Russell-led dynasty. he was known for being very detail oriented, very much into preparation, kind of a considered an eccentric at the time for his like fitness regimen and for doing calisthenics and things that we take for granted today. He was a pioneer in doing so, but did a lot of drills, scouting reports, film sessions. All these things were things that he brought to the Lakers that either were completely new or were rare in the NBA during the time. And he'd already had quite a bit of coaching success. He was he had coached Cleveland in the ABL in 62, which won the championship in that league's only season. And then the previous season in Utah for the Stars, he'd led them to a championship as well. And he'd also led the Warriors to the finals in 67 against Wilt 76ers. So he'd already had a lot of success as a coach. And of course had respect as a player. And as you mentioned, he had there was at least some anxiety between with Weston Riley over bringing the longtime Celtic over, but that dissipated quickly as they got to know him. And he was pretty much beloved by almost every player that he ever played with. I mean, a lot of guys in Utah, Zelmo Beatty, for example, sung his praises, all the time, and everyone on the Lakers, I've never heard any kind of negative thing. The only guy who didn't really get along with him, even though he liked him as a person, was Rick Barry. So, which, I guess if anyone's not going to like him, I guess Rick Barry would probably be the guy. So,
yeah.
But as you kind of alluded to before, he really changed their identity from an isolation team to a fast breaking team, which, given the age of the team, the fact that most of their top stars were older seems sort of counterintuitive. But, as Goodrich said, he convinced Wilt that if he played fast, he didn't have to come past half court so he could extend his career. So, which is interesting. I mean, you would see that a lot. In some of the highlights, he would lead the fast break and just kind of be there, and then the scoring would happen, and then it would happen so quickly that he would just basically stay on that end of the court. I know that was kind of a specialty of Kareem's later on in his career as well. But which kind of makes sense because obviously Kareem played in that fast breaking Showtime style, even though he was not he was not a fast player by that point. And also, he shifted West to become more of a ball handler and a playmaker. And then Goodrich, West kind of filled a little bit more of the Bob Cousy role in that way. And then Goodrich was more of the traditional Charmin role, where he would kind of come off screens, and then West would kind of be more of the decision maker out there. Which I think West could have filled Goodrich's role and done fine, but I don't think Goodrich could have filled West's role, because I mean not that Goodrich wasn't a smart player, but he just West obviously was a genius level player.
Yeah, and that's when you're just talking about Wilt not passing half court, and I was just looking at a Sports Illustrated story from December of 71. They were in the midst of their winning streak, but still had about 18 games to go into it. And it has a quote from Wilt. The outlet pass was something I had to be very conscious of earlier this season. It was a change of style for us then, but it's become second nature now. And it says, once Chamberlain releases the ball, he almost never touches it again. When the Lakers fast break succeeds, he usually remains standing in the defensive area of the court. And this story talks about how Charmin did go about convincing Wilt, who was the main guy he had to convince, because every previous coach of Wilt's had tried doing different things with him, and Wilt kind of decided when he would listen and when he wouldn't, but he certainly took to Charmin. But just as important was convincing Goodrich and West to alter how they played. And that's really, talk about a coaching accomplishment, that's pretty remarkable to do with not just great players, but great players who've been established for 10, 11 years, and getting them to buy into. Obviously, he'd had success as a player, and he had success as a coach, winning in the ABA, but he wasn't coming in with six rings or anything like, Phil Jackson joining the Lakers and being able to implement the triangle. So I think it's a, kind of great credit to Charmin that he was able to get not just Wilt, but Wes and Goodrich and all the players to really fit into their roles.
Yeah, I wonder if there's something to the idea of that forcing them to sort of change their style gave them some kind of challenge that sort of sparked them to excel. Because, if you're doing the same thing over and over again, you're comfortable in that and you can be successful in that. But you know, sometimes you can, you know, go through the motions a little bit, or it isn't quite as challenging for you, and maybe you're not quite doing, you know, maybe you're doing 90% of your best, or, you know, something about the fact that, you know, the fact that all of these players were playing in a slightly different way than they were used to, and the fact that they were obviously bought into that change, you know, drove them to enjoy what they were doing even more in doing what they were better, because it was, you know, the kind of the first time they had been challenged on that level in a long time.
Yeah, no, I think that's a great point. I was trying to think of other, you know, coaching comparisons to what Sharman was able to do. And one name, obvious name that kind of pops in my head is Steve Kerr. Obviously, the Warriors had nowhere near the past that the Lakers had had, but he, you know, was able to go into a team that was pretty good. And I remember when Mark Jackson was originally let go, and there was some idea that maybe the players were grumbling a little bit. But just this new system that he brought in, this freedom that he gave them, and totally changed how they played, but like you said, kind of freed up the players. And I, you know, I think that's maybe a little bit of a comparison to what Sharma was able to do there.
Yeah, that's a good one. Obviously, you know, a big difference is that the Warriors are a young team and that the Lakers are an old team. But yes, I think that is a very similar, you know, one season improvement with a fairly similar team. That, you know, is mostly explained by bringing in a new coach. And the biggest biggest thing with that Charman had to do as far as convincing goes was his idea of shoot-arounds, morning shoot-arounds, which was not something that had really been done in the NBA previously. But and you know, getting Wilt to actually buy in to do that, and you know from all accounts, Wilt was good about getting up in the morning, and at least, you know, the shoot-arounds were not necessarily intended to be strenuous. Obviously, with an old team, you probably don't want to over-practice, but just sort of the idea of, from what I kind of gathered, the real intent for the shoot-around is to encourage guys to go to bed early so that they're not, you know, sleeping super late, and, you know, to kind of get them on a, you know, decent sort of schedule like that. Which does make sense, rather than, you know, the actual shoot around itself is, you know, kind of a means to an end in that sense.
Yeah, I think, you know, the kind of an apocryphal story about Wilt and the shoot around was a player going to his room and saying Sharman wants you there for the shoot around, and Wilt saying I'll come to the arena once, you know, ask Sharman if he wants to be for the shoot around or for the game. But you're reading stories, I was reading that same Sports Illustrated story, and it talked about how Wilt was, you know, fine with the shoot arounds and was showing up to them. Yeah. And
he was
and
skeptical, but he bought in and basically, you know, went with them. So,
yeah. And that same story, you mentioned Rick Barry, and it said he was kind of the one player in Sharman's past who didn't like it because he figured if he had played 40 minutes the night before that he should be resting during the day. Yeah. So he got some resistance from there, but I think it's certainly, you know, you talk about innovative coaching techniques, and that has to be near the top, because eventually every coach at pretty much every level started doing it.
Yeah, which I think some teams, I think including even the Warriors, have gone away from shoot-arounds now because they feel like the getting the sleep is more important. Obviously, there's a balance in approaches. I mean, obviously, it worked very well for Sharman, but it's sort of interesting how the thinking changes over different times, and, you know, just you know, what we think we know ends up changing as we learn new things. But the team started off 7-3, but it came after a 4-0 start. Sharman threatened fines for everyone if the Lakers kept playing without effort, and he even said, "Me too." He told the LA Times, "If I can't get the message across, I'm feeling too." The year before, he had supposedly fined himself $100 while coaching the Utah Stars. So I like that story from Sharman. And the biggest thing was dealing with Elgin Baylor, who just wasn't really suited for playing up and down the floor and playing the number of minutes that, you know, that a starter would require. So Sharman asked him if he would be willing to come off the bench, and Elgin, you know, he said no, you know, that's not something I want to do, and retired 9 games in the season. West referred to it as almost like a death in the family, and obviously a big moment in Lakers history and a surprise. It's hard to know whether, you know, it's like you kind of say, well, if he'd been willing to hang on and do that, the Lakers would have been successful and he would have gotten his ring. But it's hard to know whether it would have worked out the same even if Elgin had been there, because I do think Elgin just changed the composition of the team so much. Even if he hadn't been playing that much, I still feel like that could have made a big difference. Not that he would have been a problem necessarily, but that just it just would have, you know, it would have been a shadow kind of hanging over the team, and it's hard to know how that would have affected things.
Yeah, and the story I was reading talked about how his style was much more, of course, isolation. And that's what made him a great player, and that's how he put up those big numbers. But at that stage of his career, because of age and even more so the injuries, he wasn't as effective with that style, even though that's still how he played. And it was no longer a match for how those Lakers were hoping to play at their peak, and which they eventually did after he retired. So, yeah, I think it definitely would have changed. Yeah, you know, the season, certainly they still would have been very good, and maybe he would have, you know, kind of fit in perfectly. But I think it's almost like expecting, you know, this season, as I watch, anytime Kobe would have a good game, I'd kind of try to imagine, well, he would be a great sixth man on a contender. But that's supposing that Kobe Bryant would be okay with playing 15 minutes per game and just bringing this instant offense, which he wouldn't be, and that's kind of defeats the whole purpose. And I think kind of a similar thing with Elgin there, where, you know, he's just such a dominant player, a dominant personality and dominant figure for so long in L.A. that it would have been very difficult, I think, for the team to kind of manage seeing this legend who is now literally on his last leg. So very, very unfortunate for him just from, you know, the way his career ended and not being able to be there for the title. But probably, you know, frankly, fortunate for the team in that it enabled them to finally play with this new style.
Mm-hmm. So McMillan, as we mentioned, moved in the starting lineup in front of Baylor. And then Sharman actually named Wilt Chamberlain captain in Baylor's place. West was offered a co-captaincy, but he declined to do that. So Wilt was the captain of the team. The first time, I believe, that he had been named captain of a team. I'd have to check that for sure, but either way, it was something that was meaningful to him, and you know he demonstrated you know some strong leadership and you know during that season, which was something that he was supposedly not known for, but he was, you know, it was something that by all accounts he took very seriously, and you know maybe another element of getting him to buy into what Charman was doing, and you know and increasing the team cohesion.
Yeah, and in a way, it kind of, which probably if Wilt could hear us today, but in a way, he kind of became sort of a more Russell-esque type player in that season, right, with concentrating on the rebounding and defense and the leadership. So I don't know if Wilt would take kindly to people, you know, pegging him with that role. Yeah. It's kind of accurate, I think.
Yeah, although, I mean, at that time, that probably was the best role for him. Yeah, I don't necessarily think that would have been the best thing for him to do, you know, in 65 or anything like that.
Exactly.
I mean, you know, maybe there are things he could have taken from Russell that would have been helpful, but, you know, but he did, I mean, you know, we talked about it in other episodes where, you know, they have some different skills. So, you know, trying to expect them to do the exact same thing is not fair to either man. And obviously, you know, Wilt, you know, you look at their numbers and you know, Wilt did some things a lot better than Russell did, even though obviously Russell had the team success. But yeah, this time, yeah, I mean, it made sense for, you know, if they were running a similar system to what the Celtics did and Wilt was able to, use his decision making and use his, you know, the defense and rebounding and you know the outlets passing in a way that obviously Russell did as well. So the 33 game winning streak itself, it began November 5th, 1971, and it's 65 days later on January 9th, 1972. The average margin of victory was 16 points, and there were four sets of back to back to backs during the streak. So three games and three nights. Games, which is, you know, pretty incredible to think about during that time. And yeah, I mean, obviously it was 33 games in 65 days. So that is more than one game for every 2 days. So, The closest games in the streak were the first game, actually, they won 110 to 106 over the Bullets. Game 18, they won 125 to 120 over the Rockets. Game 20, which tied the record for most wins in a season, Milwaukee had actually set it the year before, was against Phoenix. It was their third game in three nights, and the game went into overtime, but Goodrich was able to catch fire in overtime, and they actually ended up winning 126 to 117. Then two nights later, game 21, they broke the record by against Atlanta. They led 96-95 with 61 seconds left. And then with the 24-second clock winding down, Goodrich ended up he couldn't find a shot, so he ended up passing it to Chamberlain with a dunk for 39 seconds left, and they ended up winning 104-95. So a close call in Atlanta there. But those were the closest calls of any. Reading about the streak, are there any other games that – or anything, any of the details in these games that I mentioned that stand out to you?
I don't know. Individually, they don't. I think it's just the sheer, you know, putting them all together that is still, I think, the most remarkable thing for me. And you,
sure,
the numbers you mentioned, just playing three in a row or over that two-month span, how many games they played. And then, of course, taking into account just how different travel was back then for these teams. I think just the, you know, certainly the physical aspect of it, just the mental strength that it took to put together that streak, to me, is kind of what stands out above everything. Because, you know, certainly the social media wasn't what it was then, and there wasn't the attention where every game seems like the end of the world like it does today on a nightly basis. But once, you know, once they start approaching the Bucks, once they pass the Bucks, and you start thinking about how much longer can it go, certainly the pressure is adding in for them to keep going out there every night and really decimating teams for the most part, with the exception of some of those close games. I think it's just the sheer combination of what those 33 games represents that stands out most for me.
Yeah. The biggest blowouts were Game 5. They won 143 to 103 over the Sixers. Game 23, they won 129 to 99 over the Warriors. And Game 33, they won 134 to 98 over the Hawks. So more than 30-point blowouts in those games. They had four, or they in the 13th game in a row, they beat Detroit, and that was probably the best individual stat line for here. Wilt had 31 points, 31 rebounds, and unofficially six blocks. So that's pretty good.
Yeah, and that, you know, you talk about Wilt and his defense, and that was really, I'll talk more about it in the finals. There's a game against the Knicks where his defense really stood out, but I think that's another thing. You look at the numbers back then, and, you know, just so much more scoring as far as the NBA back then. I mean, they were putting up 120 on a regular basis, 135, 150. So certainly their offense, that fast break, was devastating, but having Wilt, you know, still back there, even at, you know, a more advanced age, certainly probably lost some athleticism, but the way he was able to control the basket, that's, if you're going to put together a long streak, you really need that defensive base.
Yeah. So Wes talked about talking about the streak later and talking about Baylor's retirement. He said that team changed overnight. It was one of those unique things that sometimes happens in sports. There was no rhyme or reason. With Jim McMillan, there's one less person who dribbled the ball, so that was left to Gail and myself. I just think that people did what they were asked to do by Bill, and then we had incredible confidence. So it's interesting that there's not really like an there's not really a reason that is concrete for why it happened. I mean, obviously Baylor's retirement helped trigger it, but I don't know. I mean, it wasn't like they added like a superstar to the team, or, you know, wasn't like they had some sort of like big change. I mean, you think losing one of the greatest superstars in NBA history would hurt your team, and then suddenly you come off this, you know, incredible thing. And the fact that it happened without much rhyme or reason, I think, is one of the kind of fascinating things about it.
Yeah, and, you know, like I said at the start of it, it was obviously this was a franchise that had a decade of success, but not a team that had won a huge amount of, you know, the Sixers held the single season victory record. So this was a team that would usually win, you know, 50 to 55, 56 games a year. And so just this kind of was this, you know, bolt of lightning that happened 33 times. And like I said, there's just no, I don't think there's one thing that really kicked it off. And it's, you know, obviously it's, I think it's just more coincidence than anything else that it just happens to start the right after Elgin retires. You know, maybe that sparks him for a few games or whatever, but to continue it for 2 months, is just, it's remains, I think, one of the more inexplicable stats in sports history.
Yes, absolutely.
One of my favorite parts of our Basketball Mysteries of the 1970s series is our awesome logo. It does a perfect job encapsulating exactly the tone and feel we wanted with the series. Well, today, I have some exciting news for you. The illustrator of that fantastic logo, Daniel J. Rowell, has made the logo, the cream and Dr. J head, as well as a bunch of other of his art, available to purchase at danieljrowell.com. Simply go to danieljrowell.com, that's DanieljRowell.com, click on merch, and you can buy sweaters, coffee mugs, shirts, and more featuring Daniel's art. Now, just in case you're still on the fence, do know that Daniel can hold a piece of toast in his mouth for a solid 45 seconds or so without dropping it. Plus, if you need a little bit more convincing, his aunt has described these shirts as fabulous. Again, to buy your tea, mug, or anything else that your little heart desires, go to Daniel J. Rowell, that's DanieljRowell.com, and click on merch.
So the end of the streak, they played a nationally televised game against the Bucks. Keith Jackson and Bill Russell were doing a commentary for the game. It is available on YouTube for anyone who wants to watch it. Sold out at Milwaukee Arena, and the Bucks win 120-104. Kareem Abdul-Jabbar has 39 points, 20 rebounds, 5 assists, and Goodrich, West, and McMillan shot a combined 17 for 55. And actually West had, he had missed the three previous losses in the season. So it was his first loss of the season after 39 wins. So, and honestly, you know, really it was from kind of watching the game, the Bucks really kind of took what the Lakers were doing and, you know, just kind of, you did a similar thing. I mean, they were looking for a lot of fast breaks. They really just kind of ran the Lakers out of the arena. And honestly, I'm sure by then the Lakers were fatigued and, you know, they were due for a night. And as we talked about before, you know, these Bucks were a historically great team. So for SRS, which we talked about, is the basketball reference metric for, you know, for team quality. The 71 Bucks had the greatest SRS season in history, 11.9. The 72 Lakers had 11.7, just below that, were third all time. And then the 72 Bucks, who they, you know, face in this game and then end up facing in the finals, had a 10.7 SRS, which is fourth all time. So, for reference, the 2016 Warriors were sixth all time and the 2016 Spurs were seventh all time. So we're talking about, at least according to these metrics, some of the most dominant teams of all time. And the fact that the Lakers, you know, again, adding to the impressiveness of what they accomplished this season, the fact that they beat, you know, the fourth greatest regular season team of all time in the Western Conference Finals to get, you know, to get through the championship is, you know, probably an underrated element of what they accomplished. And they basically prevented the Bucks from having an almost sure dynasty.
Yeah, and the end of the streak, there's the newspaper stories afterwards, Bucks coach Larry Costello was talking about how he was happy that Atlanta hadn't ended the streak a game earlier, and it was the score that you noted where the Lakers absolutely blew Atlanta off the court, so that wasn't really in jeopardy. But the Bucks, I think, were very happy that the Lakers took that streak into that game, because I don't think there's any question that they probably certainly still thought they were the team to beat, being the defending champions, going on to have an amazing regular season themselves. So I think that game probably just more than anything solidified in their minds that, yeah, they were the team to beat. And there was a quote from Chamberlain afterwards, and it's, "I'm ashamed we didn't play better," said an embarrassed Chamberlain. You know, kind of tough, Wilt being tough on himself there. They, you know, you had just won 33 games in a row. But I think the Lakers were still, maybe the loss was inevitable in some ways, going against a great team, you know, the mental fatigue, being on the road. But I certainly think the Lakers were disappointed, and the Bucks certainly felt that it was going to be a preview of what would happen if and when they did meet in the playoffs.
Absolutely. And the Lakers had lost to the Bucks in 71. It was 4-1 series. Now Baylor and West were both injured in that series, so obviously the Lakers were shorthanded. This was the first playoff battle between Kareem and Wilt. They did not play. I don't think they played at all in Kareem's rookie season because Wilt missed most of that season with injury. So the first time they played was in 71, and then the 72 series would be their second and final playoff battle. Kareem definitely got the best of the first one. The second one, definitely Wilt was able to make things harder for Kareem. He shot in the last four games, three of which were won by the Lakers. He shot just a 41%. So even though he had, he produced pretty well, he scored pretty well in a lot of the games, he did not shoot efficiently, and Wilt definitely made life tough for him. I don't think we have exact rebounding totals, but from the accounts that I've given, I think generally Wilt was able to win the rebounding battles. He was definitely the bigger and stronger guy at the time, even though, Kareem certainly challenged him. And after they beat the Bulls full straight to get here in the first round, the Lakers actually lost the first game, though. It was 93-72 in L.A., and then Wes Goodrich, Wilt, McMillan, and John Q. Trapp shot a combined 14 for 75, 19 points. It was the they set a team record for fewest playoff points. So interesting that they would lay such an egg in the first game.
Yeah, and that I mentioned earlier, they'd averaged 121. And then, of course, 72, it's a number. I mean, it's just startling in any era. It's something you'd, picture one of those mid-90s playoff series, a team scoring that. But for a team that was that incredible in the season with scoring and playing at home, there was a story in Sports Illustrated midway through that series, and it talked about the Lakers blamed a lot of that performance on the lights that ABC was using in the Forum. And Sharman himself sort of downplayed that, mentioning, of course, that the Bucks are playing in the same, same facility, same lighting. But I think it was something that sort of startled the Lakers. And like I said, they were very fortunate. Game two, then they only win by 1 point. Really could have swung that series. And really that whole series, if you look at the first four games, the Lakers win by 1 point and 3 points, and the Bucks win by 21 points and 30 points. And Costello himself was talking after, and the series is tied at two, that they've proven they're kind of the superior team. The Lakers are eking out these victories. The Bucks are blowing them off the court. But then eventually the Lakers do win the final two games comfortably in game five. And like I said, Wilt, wasn't putting up anywhere near the offensive numbers. And Kareem did still put up huge numbers. But there were moments, a big one in game three, 108-105, that the Lakers won, and Kareem went without a field goal for the final 11 minutes of the game. And obviously a lot of that because of Wilt, and he was still able to – it talked about how he was able to sort of take away some of Kareem's favorite moves. Obviously, the hook was still devastating, but Wilt did an amazing job really in helping control Kareem as much as anyone could at that stage of Kareem's career.
The Skyhook has been called unblockable, but it was blocked. I mean, it was obviously a difficult shot to block. But, McMillan really saved the Lakers in game two. I mean, he had 42 points in that game, which is career high. As you mentioned, the Lakers won by one in that game. That really was a, if that had not gone well, that series could have definitely changed a lot. One other thing is that Oscar Robertson had an abdominal strain, never really was a factor in the series. He only had 2 points in the final game, game six. Heading into game six, Wilt actually called a team meeting and, basically said, I'm at a point in my career where, where this guy is better than I am. I'm not the best guy on the floor anymore, but I have the better teammates, and was, kind of a way of like rallying his team and, telling him that he had all the confidence in the world and that they could beat the Bucks, and they were able to win game six, 104-100. Wilt had 20 points, West had 25 points, and Kareem had 37 points, to lead all scorers. But again, you know, the shooting percentage wasn't quite there, even though he averaged 34 points and 18 rebounds in the series. He only shot 46% during the series, while his season mark was 57%. So, and basically, yeah, the Bucks won their two games by a combined 47 points, and they lost the other four games by a combined 33 points, and three of those games by a combined 8 points. So they actually outscored the Lakers in this series, but they still lost it in six. So kind of a crazy series in a lot of ways, but you know, a testament for the Lakers for being able to pull it out.
And I think another thing that stands out from that series was Jerry West suffering through a horrific shooting slump that then carried over into the finals against the Knicks. And it kind of became, and he talked about it, and he was very frustrated by it, that he was playing what he considered, and I think most people would consider, the worst ball of his career. But his team is playing better than ever. His team ends up winning the title, which he, of course, was elated about, very grateful for, relieved, maybe more than elated.
Yeah.
But he was frustrated by the fact that he was going through this terrible shooting slump, and Sports Illustrated wrote about how at one of the practices he went to kick a scoreboard or a chair, a table, and he missed and would have done some damage. And a bench player said, you know, take it easy, Jerry. But he was just so frustrated by how his shot was off. And he talked about how his jump shot at that time was like a slice that a golfer was suffering through. So it was really kind of remarkable that the Lakers were able to, you know, you don't have Wilt at his offensive peak, of course. You have Jerry West playing the worst basketball of his playoff career, but yet they are able to beat this dominant team. It's really a testament to, you know, when you talk about most impressive teams ever, I think that kind of goes on their resume, the fact that they were able to overcome those types of things, yet still win in six games.
Yeah, and So they go to the finals against the Knicks, who had beaten them in a classic seven-game series in 1970. And the Lakers, they do lose the first game at home again. Another egg in game ones, which is sort of interesting how they had to do that. It reminds me a little bit of how the Heat were known for that. We're sort of known for, you know, kind of coming from behind, or, you know, losing game ones. Like, that's happened, I feel like, in LeBron in several of his series, where, you know, for whatever reason, they have to kind of get behind, or have to sort of like find that drive within themselves before they can actually, you know, overcome the odds and pull it out. And obviously it works out for a lot of times, and it worked out for the Lakers this year. But Jerry Lucas and Bill Bradley had incredibly hot shooting. Willis Reed was out during the series, so Lucas was able to, you know, kind of fill his up. And, you know, Lucas was more of an outside shooter, so he would have been somebody who, you know, Wilt didn't like to go out into the perimeter and deal with, you know, the outside shootings. I mean, the one thing that the Knicks were very successful on is they basically had – they could shoot from basically any position, so they had a lot of – they were able to create a lot of spacing. That was really part of their philosophy at the time, was to – especially when they're playing the Lakers, was to, you know, try to draw the big man out when, you know, Wilt did not like to do that. Obviously, he, you know, preferred to play inside, as most big men did during the time.
Yeah, it's kind of, you know, you talk about modern game with, you know, obviously they didn't have a three-pointer then, but there were stories back then during that series where it talked about how the Knicks, you know, were battling while shooting jump shots, and how that was, you know, their best way they could play, but how over a five-game series, you know, potential seven-game series where that, at that time especially, where you're not being rewarded for shooting from further out, that was just a very difficult way to overcome a team that did have someone like Wilt inside, who, not averaging 50 points per game, but is still very effective down there. So it was kind of this contrast. And the Knicks, I think, were just sort of outmanned and outarmed that series, but still gave, you know, a very good performance. And key game in game four that goes overtime in New York. Lakers were leading 2-1, but if the Knicks win that, it's 2-2, and you have to think a lot of those bad memories for the Lakers would have sparked up again. But instead, the Lakers win in overtime. And one of the big things about that game is, again, Wilt, who would go on to be finals MVP and really kind of, you know, certainly earned it with the way, you know, West was struggling. But Wilt picks up a fifth foul late in regulation. He has famously never fouled out in his career, with a fact that he's very aware of and was very proud of. but people would sort of criticize him for, you know, believing that maybe he would, you know, play off a little bit to not foul out. But then in overtime, a key possession after the Lakers take a lead, he blocks Jerry Lucas. The Knicks regain possession. He gets another block. There's a 24-second violation. The Lakers go down and take a four-point lead and go on to win. And just kind of really solidified how Wilt was still able to dominate, even if he wasn't putting up the huge numbers from earlier in his career.
Yeah, and in that game, early in that game, he sprained his wrist, but he still was able to play off 53 minutes. He had 24 rebounds, and really played a great game. You know, by the end, he actually has little splints around his fingers. On both hands, he has these bandages on both hands. You know, he's battling through, and despite that, is managing to do. And it's kind of crazy. In that game, the Lakers only use seven players. The fact that they, you know, play an overtime game, 53 minutes, Will plays the entire time, and they only use, seven players during that time. And the Lakers used eight players. Of course, Earl Monroe was hurt during that series. DeBuscher was in and out with a lot of injuries, although he played 48 minutes in game four and played pretty well. So obviously both teams were dealing with were either shorthanded by choice or by either just shorthanded because they didn't quite have the depth, or shorthanded because they were dealing with injuries. But game five, it was close at halftime. The Lakers pulled away in the second half. Wilt had 24 points and 29 rebounds. Also had 8 assists and unofficially had 8 blocked shots. While Frazier had a good game for the Knicks with 27 points, 7 rebounds, and 10 assists, but the Lakers won their first championship 114-100. It was in Los Angeles. It was their eighth try at a championship in Los Angeles. They finally were able to pull it off. That was the eighth try for West. Yes, because he was in for all of them in Los Angeles. That's right. So, and as you mentioned, Chamberlain for the series averaged 19.4 points, 23.2 rebounds. He was the MVP. And as you mentioned with West, he was frustrated that he played terrible basketball, although he was a good playmaker. You know, he had 13 assists in one game.
Yeah.
He was doing other things, even though his shot was off. But, you know, he said it didn't seem like justice for him because he contributed so much in years when he lost. And then when he won, he was, quote, just another piece of the machinery. It was particularly frustrating because I was playing so poorly that the team overcame me. And then, of course, they would battle in 1973 again. These two teams in the finals, it would go better for the Knicks with Willis Reed there and some changes in the team. But that will have to be discussed in a future basketball mystery of the 1970s. So, Sean, before we go, is there anything else you'd like to discuss about this team?
No, just briefly back to kind of the two main guys, Wilt and West. And
sure.
After the title, Sports Illustrated, I just looking at it now again, the line Lakers have won, and talking about Wilton, it said, in the end, he shut up, perhaps forever, those critics who for years claimed that he was a quitter, that he could not win important games. And unfortunately for Wilt, 40-plus years later, he didn't shut up those critics in many ways, because there's still, unfortunately, a lot of people who do lay those claims on him. And if that series, didn't shut him up, nothing he would have done, it could have done that. But it really was kind of a nice cap for Wilt, who had, unlike West, had won a previous title. But to show his critics at the time, and if people today who might criticize him, if they do look back at that series especially and see just everything that he could do, might change some people's opinion. And then West, just how it... reading the stories after they win, and like I said a little bit ago, it was, I don't know if it was so much celebration or elation for him, just this weight off his shoulders finally, but being counteracted by the fact that he didn't play very well. But there was a quote, and I actually used it in my book, but after they won, he told reporters, "The feelings I have now are private ones. I'm at a loss for any more words. I'm going to go back home and lock the door." And just that mentality that I think is so foreign to think of today, but it really kind of sums up, just he was this driven figure, kind of tormented for so long by these demons of what the Lakers had suffered through. So the 72 season really, in many ways, it was a celebration of, you know, what basketball could be. And they're kind of, I think even today, you can hold them up as a perfect example of when a great team comes together, what they can accomplish. But in many ways, it was, you know, still sort of this bittersweet culmination, especially for West.
Yeah, and to because their success is also a reminder of their failures a bit.
Exactly.
Because you see, oh, okay, this is what you could have done, you know, when everything goes together. Why didn't you do it more? I mean, which is, you know, obviously silly and unfair, but but you know, there's that, and you know, Wes, as you mentioned, was incredibly hard on himself. I mean, if you ever read his autobiography, you know, it is very much a portrayal of him and his torments and his eccentricities and his personality. And he's definitely a guy who you are, you know, rooting for to have peace and have confidence and have even though he's had a lot of great success in his life, he's still you're hopeful he can find happiness, or at least he finds happiness in a lot of things in his life. But so speaking of your book, do you want to tell listeners who haven't heard your other episodes about a little bit about your book?
Of course I will. Rise and Fire, you mentioned it's about the history of the jump shot. And I was just thinking last week after the Cavs won, this was kind of the year of the jump shot with Steph and Klay Thompson going crazy, Villanova winning the national title with the three-pointer at the buzzer, Kyrie winning the title for the Cavs with his amazing shot. So it's kind of the perfect time, I think, if people want to read about where the jump shot came from, where it started, and how it's really changed basketball from the time it came into the game in the 30s through the 50s, through these great guys of the 60s with West, Oscar, Hal Greer, and then up to the modern game with the three-pointer. I hope people check it out.
Cool. And where can people find you on the internet if they want to follow you on Twitter or know more about you?
Twitter is at Sean Fury, SHAWNFURY, and SeanFury.com has a lot more information about the book as well.
Cool. All right, Sean. Well, thank you so much for joining me today. Really appreciate it. And for everyone, of course, thanks for listening. You can find our podcast at harborparoxysm.com. You can find us on Twitter and Facebook at Over and Back NBA. And we appreciate any feedback you want to give us. Hopefully you're enjoying these basketball mysteries of the 70s. It's our plan for our off-season series to continue looking at the most interesting teams and players and subjects of the decade and dig deeper into them and try to unravel what's a very complicated and complex decade. Give us an iTunes rating, if you would, a favorable one. We'd like those. We're also on Stitcher. You can find us there and give us a review there. And I think that's about it. So until next time, thanks for listening, and we'll talk to you again soon.
Next time on Basketball Mysteries of the 1970s.
Yeah, it's a pattern that keeps on going. And I mean, it's sort of like anything with history, you know, you're always like doomed to repeat it if you don't like want to actually pay attention. I guess the Knicks have never chosen to pay attention to what they've done in the past.